the Defense Department believes it is on the right track to reach auditability in 2017. One of the key elements of that is getting its pay system functioning well. DOD's DIMERS system was supposed to do that, but the Pentagon canceled it after it spent billions of dollars on the system and had nothing to show for it. Former Defense Department comptrollers tell me the complexity of the DOD pay system, especially for uniformed personnel, is one of the biggest challenges to a streamlined, modernized process. Mark Easton is Deputy Chief Financial Officer at the Defense Department. I talked to him at the Pentagon this morning for today's edition of Pentagon Solutions. He explains exactly why DOD's pay system is so complex and what the agency's up against. The private sector organizations and even other federal agencies don't have to deal with.
I think it's the nature of the entitlement process, particularly with our uniformed military. So we have men and women in uniform that are operating around the world in our defense, both in the active forces and in the reserve. At a moment's notice, their particular entitlements to their salary, either in the form of pay or allowances, can change. An example of immediate change, if you're called up and deployed. In other words, all of a sudden you're entitled to imminent danger pay, different kinds of pays. Those are things that are sort of inherent part of the job and beyond the member's control. But those kinds of business events have to be communicated back to the pay process. In some cases, things happen to you of a disciplinary nature. I mean, actually, you have responsibility for those things, and your pay changes because you've been subject to disciplinary action. You may have been entitled to a bonus if you've completed a particular school. You get the bonus, but you fail to complete the school. That changes your pay. All of those individual events have an impact. And so those events take place in the field around the world. I think that we have a lot of people in the personnel community that work very hard to be able to take those events and communicate them. Some events are fairly routine. Promotions, for example, are centrally maintained. And so those events are communicated oftentimes in an automated way with very little manual intervention. And so we have different rates, and we track those things. We measure how well we're able to do that from a timeliness and accuracy perspective. So that's really where the complexity is in the process. And so let me tell you a story about going back almost 40 years when I was a dispersing officer. In a totally manual mode, I had responsibility for approximately 200 sailors. I had their pay record, and I ate breakfast every morning with the personnel officer who had their personnel record. And so we had a very, very tight, albeit locally controlled process that was probably not very efficient. We spent a lot of time, offices were ashore, and this took place in all services. Over time, we've leveraged automation. But at the same time, the responsibility between systems and processes to be able to communicate those rapid changes, involve interfaces. And so as we talk about the complexity of the process, the automation that we've applied in some cases requires a lot of manual intervention and requires a lot of people to do their job. And I'd say in the vast majority of cases, they do. But that's really the difference. And either in the civilian pay, not to say that our civilian pay situations when we deploy a civilian, the expeditionary forces to Afghanistan, creates some complexity there that is similar, and we have to watch that very carefully. But the lion's share of pay for a white-collar office worker, for example, or for the vast majority of people in the private sector is pretty stable. So that's the difference, I think.
So what does that mean? What's the implication for that for the back end, for the administration of all of that, as far as how you have to construct a system that's going to be able to spit out the results for every individual person?
What you need to do is you have to think end-to-end. So we've got to be able to take, and you may have heard some of the same kinds of things, we take a look at the process, we identify where the automation is available, and we have to very carefully manage those interfaces. We have to identify certain areas that are particularly vulnerable to risk, and that's where we need to place controls in place. And so that's the thought process. And you look at some of the GAO reports, and they will point to specific controls that they're saying you need to strengthen those.
Mm-hmm. They have the number as 2,200 financial management systems inside DOD. Is that a number that you concur with? And is that the number that you expect to use moving forward, or are we still in a mode where you're trying to consolidate some of those systems?
We're working very closely with the Deputy Chief Management Officer, formerly Elizabeth McGrath. Currently that position's vacant, but under her auspices and leadership, we have developed portfolios. And I think in the financial management portfolio, we count by our count, because some of the numbers, I think, Francis, you're referencing, going back to articles or reports that have been issued sometimes years ago. And so our count in the financial management portfolio right now is much closer to 350 systems. And we are moving forward to try to, because we've made investments, as you know, in enterprise resource programs, more modern systems, much of which are integrated, and so it's not just a financial system. It could be a financial system that handles other kinds of applications. But as we invest in those systems, what we're trying to do is make sure we're not duplicating that. But at the same time, we have to develop sort of a roadmap. How do we develop fewer of those systems and making sure that those systems are interoperable and work better together, and applying those to a process like the military pay process that we've talked about?
So in conjunction with Beth's office, you've reduced that number substantially, and yet we hear only about the ones that didn't work. Tell me about a couple where you've had successes and you've been able to make these moves in a way that benefits the person in the theater or your civilians here inside the Pentagon or whatever.
We think that we've had a lot of successes. The systems that don't deliver as advertised, I think, are the ones that you hear about. The Army has rolled out their General Fund Enterprise Business System called GFIBS across the board. They are using that to develop an increased degree of standardization. They will interface it with the legacy military pay system while they wait for their future systems modernization effort, which is taking place. It has provided, and we're getting some feedback from audit examinations, it's providing an increased standardization. It's forcing the Army to relook at how their resources are allocated. And I'd venture to say that resources will become more constrained. And they are looking at their whole financial management footprint. And GFIBS is sort of the centerpiece for that. So I think it's going to save them money, but it forces them to do business a little bit differently.
The issue of legacy systems, how widespread is that? How many of these systems that you're trying to consolidate or change or modernize are really old legacy systems? We have a story on federalnewsradio.com about the Railroad Retirement Board using a COBOL system that's 40 years old. Do you have systems like that inside DOD, and what's the timeline or desire even to bring those up to modern standards?
We do. And in some cases there's been efforts made. I mean, the two systems that are COBOL-based that I think are the most, and they were referred to in several reports that you may have read or heard of. One's the military pay system, what we call DJMS, the Defense Joint Military Pay System. It's COBOL-based. Again, it works well, but it has some limitations in terms of flexibility and documentation. The older that a system is, the more likely your documentation is not as robust as you would like it to be, because the documentation is the key to your ability to move forward. The other system that I mentioned is a system called MOCAS. It's a system that is used to both entitle and pay, as well as support administration of major contracts payments. And again, that system has been maintained, I think, and enhanced, but at the same time, our ability to modernize it is a challenge, particularly because of some of the uniqueness of defense procurement and contract administration. I mean, that's the challenge. I think that when we get into some of these ERPs, oftentimes we overestimate our ability to change our processes and overestimate the capabilities of the software. And so those are lessons that we're applying. And so I think that DJMS will be with us. I mean, it's doing a good job, but as I mentioned, some of the shortcomings in terms of the documentation and the fact that it's not as agile as we would like it to be. So we're going to stick with those systems until we make sure that we have something that's going to take its place properly.
Is it fair to say, too, that it's rather clunky to try to interface a system like that with something more modern?
That's fair to say. It's fair to say, but we're working those interfaces very, very hard. For example, I mentioned GFIBS, which is the Army system. The other system in the Navy is the Navy ERP. So let's take a look at that procure-to-pay process when we're dealing with MOCAS and that and the end-to-end process. You know, right now we're looking at what we call handshakes to make sure that those interfaces are passing the right information and finding out how much do we need to extend. I hesitate to use the word customize because with a commercial off-the-shelf software product, when you customize it, you buy into other problems. But those are the hard questions that when we initially implement, being able to test these modern systems end-to-end becomes very, very difficult. And oftentimes we don't find out, we don't know what we don't know until after we've put them into operation, but we're applying the lessons. The Navy ERP, I think, was able to do some things to refine those relationships, and the Army's taking a look at those things to make sure, to be able to get the lessons that they can and apply those. But it does, when we as financial managers get together, it emphasizes another thing, and that's the fact that it's not just the financial management community. We need to reach out to the contracting officers of the world to make sure that, you know, and I just to tell you a quick story, when we were implementing the Navy ERP, the executive director at the Naval Air Systems Command, where we went first, you know, as we started to implement, he, you know, takes me aside and says, Mark, because you mean we're writing contracts that you can't pay in an automated way? And I said, unfortunately, that's very true. And so what we're trying to do is to start, you know, begin with the end in mind. And so we'll look at it end-to-end to make sure what can we do about the way you write your contract and what can we do about the tools that we have to make sure that we can minimize manual intervention. But at the same time, there's not a lot of organizations that are buying aircraft carriers and joint strike fighters. And so the complexity of that contracting process, the size of those contracts is clearly daunting.
That's Mark Easton, the Deputy Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Defense, my guest on today's edition of Pentagon Solutions. And my conversation with Mark Easton continues in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio on Pentagon Solutions today. My conversation continues with Mark Easton, the Deputy Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Defense. In the first part of our conversation, he talked about using business practices to improve financial management at the Pentagon and told me about the collaboration between the Comptroller's Office and the Deputy Chief Management Officer's Office. In this part of our conversation at the Pentagon today, I asked him if the push for business practices is coming primarily from the Comptroller's Office or from the DCMO's office?
I think it's a partnership. I would say, and this is a partnership that I think is very clearly aligned to our strategy all along. When we've talked before about the financial audit as an example, in other words, the financial audit requires the full enterprise understanding of what they need to do. And it really is not particularly complicated. We need to capture business events at the source, capture them in a transaction way, make sure those transactions are processed end to end. So that concept is what's espoused by the DCMO. What we are doing in the comptroller community, particularly in our financial improvement and audit readiness effort, is to step back and look at the business and make sure that we understand what we're doing to ourselves as we go through. And so this was a lesson that at least I have learned is that we really need to take that look up front before we invest in the computer system, the automated system, because that informs exactly what you do. And I say that, and I'd venture to say my colleagues both inside the department and other federal agencies would shake their head if I said that 10 years ago we might have invested in this enterprise resource program with an overly simplified view of what it would do for us. Mm-hmm. So I would say that many times people says, well, this system is CFO compliant. salesperson might have said that to us. And so we're thinking that if we implement this, we'll be able to produce auditable financial statements. And as it turns out, it's not quite as easy as that. So I think that we've tried to work together the discovery process that we're using to try to improve and strengthen our processes, improve the quality of financial information, is exactly what you need to do to understand what you want to get out of that new system.
We've spoken a lot about lessons learned, Mark. What lessons do you take away from the Dimerses of the world and some of the other systems that didn't do what you wanted them to do as to how you approach where you're going to go forward so that you don't do those things again?
I think that over-reliance on a system integrator is a lesson that comes up. The importance of governance, and that's not to say that we don't have governance. Governance over our acquisition processes, for sure, but we need to begin to look at small pieces and then evaluate our progress so that we get feedback. I think that we need to try to incentivize transparency to make sure that, because I think that in my experience we have a can-do attitude in the Department of Defense, and I say that in the most positive way. I mean, we're mission-oriented, and in many regards we can get the job done. In applying some of this technology, particularly from a change management perspective, sometimes we overestimate our ability to be able to understand where we are. So I think that we're trying very hard. The constrained resources are helping us, because I think that that we're critically looking at these investments. Many of them are out there. They're working well. But there's still things that we can do to refine them, but we're looking very critically at future investments to make sure that we're going to get what we need.
That's Mark Easton, the Deputy Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Defense, my guest on today's edition of Pentagon Solutions. DOD's facing some pretty heavy deadlines for auditability. The biggest one is 2017, when the department's books are supposed to be fully auditable. Several former financial management officials at DOD tell me they're skeptical the agency can make those deadlines. And I ask Mark Easton why he and his colleagues are so confident they can make it.
We need to spend a few minutes talking about what those marks mean, I guess, before we move on to confidence factors. Because I'll tell you up front, I'm optimistic, but I'm also a realist. And understanding the size, the scale, and the complexity of the department, that's where the realism sets in. And as John Hamry, one of the former comptrollers, I'm not sure if that's who you were
mentioned. He's not one of them.
Making changes, because in many regards this financial improvement and with the audit as sort of the desired outcome, he's referred to making changes in the department as sort of changing a tire on an airplane when you're flying. So, those are the kinds of things. There's a lot going on. So I want to couch my optimism. But let's talk about both of those dates. Secretary Panetta in 2011, I think it was October 2011, he saw the 2017 date. He clearly was engaged and very supportive of that date, but he wanted to put an interim goal that would be meaningful, albeit a stretch goal. So that's where we came up with 2014. We were in the midst of the Marine Corps audit of the SBR at that time. Actually, their second year. And I say second year because I think that when we say, what's the goal, if the goal is a clean audit opinion, on any given statement, or quite frankly, all statements, which is our 2017 goal, if we look at history, it's taking many years for any federal agency of any scope and size to be able to accomplish that goal. So you have to look at it, and we've tried to couch it in terms of audit readiness. We've tried to focus on the budgetary priorities and existence and completeness, but the budgetary priorities are aligned with the SBR, and so. One of the reasons that I'm optimistic is because we've at least gone through the first wicket of our road to the SBR, and we've called that the schedule of budgetary activity, which is really current year business processes for the Marine Corps. At the time when Secretary Panetta was targeting that 2014 date, we clearly had in mind being ready to go into an audit of the SBR. We found out from the Marine Corps experience that it wasn't a smart way to approach this. I mean, we could continue to struggle for multiple years to be able to get all of the pieces. And I say the big piece that is really missing is sort of a starting point, the beginning balance that is the key to sort of a starting point on a financial statement so that you can say where you ended, the ending balance that they're issuing an opinion on. We found that it's a more cost-effective way to build those balances over time. So that's where the schedule of budgetary activity comes. And so if you go back to the thought process, audit readiness means your people, your business systems, your capability to support the audit, and your IT environment is ready. We think we're going to be ready by the end of 2014. But it doesn't mean an opinion on either the schedule of budgetary activity necessarily, but it does mean we'll be ready to go into an audit regimen in 2015 for most of the department. And I say most because, you know, we've just gone through a pretty tough year from a budgetary turmoil perspective, a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, we've been set back by that a little bit, and so we're reassessing what do we need to do with the remaining time between now and October.
Well, and that's where I wanted to go next. These deadlines were all laid out well before sequestration, shutdown, and so on. What impact does that have on your deadlines? I mean, those seem to be, from your perspective, you can make a pretty good case that that these are setbacks that should buy you some more time.
Well, we think – I mean, what we think is that we will be close enough to be able to enter an audit regimen for most of the department and gain value from that. I mean, if we didn't think that we could do that, we wouldn't start. But we think that we'll be in a position to do that for most of the department. I say most of the department are military components. That's what we're looking at right now, to say how do we recover if we could not, if we have missed interim goals, and we have, how can we recover and prioritize to do the things that we need to do by the end of this year? And so that's our strategy right now, and I'm optimistic about that because I think that once, and Francis giving you a Super Bowl analogy, not the score, of course, but the analogy that says you need to get into the game. We've been in the locker room. We've been practicing. We've been going through. We've actually had people, you know, public accounting firms come in and grade us on our workouts. In other words, we've had examinations. But we need to get into the game and get into those game conditions, and that's the audit regimen that we want to be in 2015. And then how will that lead? I mean, it will lead to the full SBR, and that same thought process will apply to 2017. So when we get to 2017, we want to be ready to undergo a full financial statement audit. And again, it's the goal, and people say, well, did you make the goal or not? I think it's more of a journey. It's sort of like running a marathon. In other words, if you tell me that I have to run it in under 3 hours, that's a problem. But if you tell me that I'm going to be in better shape because I've trained more disciplined business processes, you know, and I'm going to have a coach that's going to come see me every year, that auditor will come see me every year. And so that vision, I think, is going to begin to form in 2015. When we begin those audits, and it will materialize from a financial reporting perspective in 2017. And if you were looking at this in a black and white and the audit opinion, you know, that's all that you'll be satisfied with. I'm afraid that it will take several years. But this is not anything that we haven't said for a long time. I do want to emphasize the progress, though. I think that we don't spend nearly enough time looking at the progress, particularly in the last 4 years under clearly the secretaries of defense, beginning with Secretary Gates, Secretary Panetta, now Secretary Hagel, being very supportive. I mean, that's a little bit of a new phenomenon. Not that they weren't interested before, but they've been very publicly engaged, and so that has trickled down to throughout the whole department. So if you were to stop here in the Pentagon and ask someone about financial improvement audit readiness 5 years ago, I don't know that I would want to bet you how many people would recognize it. I can tell you now that people recognize it. And our job is to translate that awareness and recognition into reality.
That's Mark Easton, the Deputy Chief Financial Officer at the Defense Department, my guest on today's edition of Pentagon Solutions. More from Mr. Easton in a moment on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now your DOD report. The Defense Department may house the only people in Washington that think the agency will make its 2017 deadline to be fully financially auditable. Several former financial management officials from the agency say they're skeptical DOD will make it, but the agency's Deputy Chief Financial Officer, Mark Easton, is optimistic. He says several components of the agency are already far along the road to contributing their share toward auditability.
The Army is undergoing a pretty full-blown examination of most of their users of GFIBs now. I think that we've gotten good positive feedback. But the Air Force, to give an example, has demonstrated that at least at some level they can transactionally reconcile their checkbook, the funds balance with Treasury. We're in the process, and we will be focused in the next several months on putting those pieces together. There's still risk in being able to put all of the elements together. So we're working very closely with the agencies within the Fourth Estate, with the military components. They have a lot of their own capacity to do that. And with our service providers, DFAS is probably the best example, to be able to put the pieces together. And we have met with our auditor, the DODIG. So we're in the process of entering this, but there's still challenges. There's technical challenges. It's a huge organization, and so we're going to find things that we've missed. And so I hesitate to be overly optimistic, but I think that there's a lot of positives. I mentioned the Marine Corps. I've just introduced you to our new fire director, who is coming from outside of the Department of Defense, having experience getting clean opinions within the Department of Transportation, as well as the Coast Guard and Homeland Security. So we're bringing the right people together. So those are the things and the feedback that we're getting from these examinations that makes me feel optimistic. But I don't want to be overly optimistic, and I'm not guaranteeing a win. But I am guaranteeing that we're going to be in the game and we're going to be making progress. And if we look at experience in the rest of the federal government, it takes several years. But we want that progress to instill confidence, not to undermine our confidence.
You said there's risk in putting those pieces together. What are the risks that are involved there?
I think it's just inherent in the fact that we're trying to create an enterprise picture. And going back to our discussion before when we talked about the myriad of systems, we are still working on standardization of data. We're still working on management of interfaces between these systems. When we try to put that picture together for the whole Department of Defense, it becomes a challenge because the auditor starts with the financial statement and they want to know what's behind that particular number on the financial statement, and they want to have confidence. And so that confidence comes from a number of things. It could come from conversations, looking at documentation of how we do business, understanding how we do business. But in the final analysis, we've got to be able to bring together a universe of transactions to give them confidence in that number. That's the technical challenge that I think that we face. And then after because we have, millions and millions of transactions, but we're doing it. The Marine Corps did it. We're working through that with all of the components, and so that's the technical challenge that we face.
Last question I want to loop back to. You mentioned DFAS and their role in this. Given some of the issues with DFAS that we've talked about and that have been documented other places, does that turn out to be an impediment to you to be able to get to where you want to be, or is it something that you're able to work with them on or work around to get to the end goal?
Well, the good news is that DFAS is part of our OSD comptroller family, and so I would absolutely not characterize them as an impediment. They are a major contributor, a major service provider. I think that if you talk to any of the federal agencies, if they were using the Department of Agriculture Finance Center, for example, in other words, they would look to that partnership as critical to the audit. And so to underestimate the importance of DFAS and their role, you can't underestimate it. It's very, very important, but they're working. They have demonstrated and gone out with their processes and systems, some of which we already talked about, and they've had an auditor look at those systems from a service provider role, and they've actually gotten positive opinions. They provide civilian pay service to three or four other non-defense agencies, and when those non-defense agencies get their audit, they rely on the audit that's been done on the DFS process. So we're making progress on that. But it's a new frame of reference. Clearly we've always understood this, but this has been an enterprise priority, and so, you know, DFS could only make so much progress on some of these challenges when their customer was a partner with them. And the FIRE effort, our financial improvement and audit readiness effort, has really made that partnership a reality. Or said another way, it gives you something to measure your partnership against. Because we have, as I've kiddingly said, you know, some of this has been sort of a self-graded exercise. The audit provides a consistent standard outside look that I think will make us better. And I think that we're already good, but this is going to make us better.
I want to thank you very much for your time.
Could I say something about the Scott Paltrow articles?
Of course, please.
I meant to say this up front because many of the things that we talked about really are highlighted in Mr. Paltrow's article. And the first thing that I would want to do is to point everyone in your audience who might have run across those Reuters articles to the comments Bob Hale had made, basically saying that he was disappointed because the picture that I think is portrayed in those articles, we don't feel is representative. I also have to say that I'd have to commend Mr. Paltrow on spending the time to study a very, very complex business environment. And to the extent that he references many GAO and DODIG reports, we agree. Or we've had an opportunity to do that. We agree, and so the fact that that he starts with that base, we're on board. We're with him. What we are disappointed of is that we think that he applies a perspective or a frame of reference, and then having accumulated a lot of information, talked to many people, many of which are retired, and you'd mentioned that you talked to former comptrollers. He's taken those quotes and he's taken data that support his frame of reference, but not necessarily provide a balanced perspective. And so if GAO were to do an analysis of his articles, they might say that he doesn't have the evidence to back up some of his conclusions. The information in many cases is dated. But I wanted to come back to where I started. In other words, there's a basis in fact that says we've got weaknesses that we need to work on. And so we're committed to doing that. We think that when we've spent some time talking about the progress that we made, and we're very proud of that. We're very proud of the men and women who are supporting our men and women in uniform. And so the culture of the department doesn't lend itself to emphasis on business, but we're changing that. But one of the points that came out of one of Mr. Paltrow's articles that focused on military pay, I think that we do have a culture, in my experience, that says that we will move heaven and earth to make sure our men and women in uniform are paid correctly. Having said that, when we're paying several million people, there's going to be problems. We talked a little bit about some of the things that can drive those problems. And so none of that is acceptable. We think that we put in place processes to make sure that those are the exceptions rather than the rule. So I would want your audience to know that those exceptions are not representative, at least in that particular case. But we don't want to do the same thing that Mr. Paltrow's done. GAO comes and says, for example, we feel very confident in our improper payments, and this is a government-wide initiative. GAO has come back and said, we understand why you feel good about it, but we don't think that you have the evidence to be able to support that. And so we've taken that aboard as well. The financial improvement and audit readiness effort, it gives us that lesson. In other words, we need to be able to support our business both with evidence and so we're on board with that. We've got work to do. And we think we're making progress.
That's Mark Easton, the Deputy Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Defense, my guest on Pentagon Solutions today.